Good evening, everyone, and welcome to the panel discussion focusing on risk communication and outrage management. My name is Barbara Campany from GHD, and I'll be your MC this evening. Now, that sounds terrible. Do I need to lean in closer, or is it echoing? Is that okay like this? Right. I'd like to, firstly, before I start, acknowledge the traditional owners, both past and present, the Gadigal people of the Eora Nation on whose land we are meeting tonight. Welcome to our special guests, Rob Stokes, Minister for Planning, and Dr. Sandman, preeminent speaker on risk communication, both of whom I will introduce shortly. To you, our invited guests, including Department of Planning and your executive directors and directors who have been through 2 days of this training already. Carolyn McNally is unable to come tonight. She had a last-minute apology, and she did, I know, on good reference, that she thoroughly enjoyed the session last week. So I'm hoping for her that this will prove quite a good evening for her staff. To Urban Growth, New South Wales Chief, Urban Growth New South Wales, our Chief Executive, David Pitchford, who's here tonight and sat through this session last year with his staff, and they've returned again last week to attend some training as well to consolidate that thinking and practice. To your members of your corporate management team and your other staff that are here tonight. To our many guests from New South Wales EPA, including CEO Barry Buffier, to Terry Barley, who is the OEH Chief Executive, to Mark Gifford, Chief Environmental Regulator, who approached us in January early this year to see if we could squeeze in 2 days for the EPA, so we were delighted to be able to accommodate that as well. To IAP2's CEO, Michelle Blickhavs, terrible pronunciation, who has assisted by spreading the word around the public sessions we've actually been running today and will be finishing tomorrow, and to many IAP2 members who are also here tonight. To our GHD executive team and senior managers who continue to support the thought leadership and professional development of the stakeholder engagement services. To all of our seminar delegates who have participated over the past 2 weeks in a series of inspiring lectures. I hope that this panel discussion provides some inspiration to all of us as we strive as professionals to build healthier, respectful, sustainable stakeholder relationships in all of the work that we do. I'd like to just introduce Rob Stokes. Rob Stokes is the Minister, New South Wales Minister for Planning. Prior to the appointment, he has served as the Minister for the Environment, Minister for Heritage, Minister for the Central Coast and Assistant Minister for Planning, as well as Parliamentary Secretary for Renewable Energy and Energy Innovation. Rob was awarded a PhD in law in 2008. He was previously a lawyer and academic in environment and planning law. Rob holds a lifelong interest in environmental protection and planning, heritage and sustainability. Elected to the New South Wales Parliament as the member for Pittwater in 2007, re-elected in 2011 and 2015, Rob represents the interests of approximately 65,000 residents in a range of suburbs and coastal hamlets across 175,000 square kilometres of outer metropolitan Sydney. He is patrol captain at Mona Vale Surf Club and an honorary fellow at Macquarie University. Rob and Sophie live in Sydney's northern beaches and are busy raising 3 children. I would like to thank the Minister for opening the formal seminars last week and for giving his time to us this evening. It is with great pleasure we welcome him to the panel discussion. Dr. Peter Sandman, creator of the risk equals hazard plus outrage formula for risk communication. Dr. Sandman is arguably one of the world's preeminent risk communication speakers and advisors. He has helped both governments and industries alike with a wide range of public controversies that threatened corporate or government reputation, from oil spills to labour management battles, from vaccine autism scares to the siting of hazardous waste facilities. In the terms first popularised by Dr. Sandman, these are usually situations where the hazard is low and the outrage is high, and the core task is outrage management. He also works on the opposite sort of risk problem when the hazard is high and the outrage is low, getting people to wear seatbelts, for example. Over the past 2 weeks, he's been delivering a series of thought-provoking and intensive risk communication and outrage management seminars to senior staff, project and communication professionals within a number of government agencies, including New South Wales EPA, Department of Planning and Environment, and Urban Growth New South Wales, among others. I'd like to just pause. We have today in the public session have representatives from state government and from industries across from every state of Australia. So that's a pretty impressive list of guests, and I'd like to just acknowledge all of you for making the effort to come to something like this and making it as special as it is. It's been amazing. And to those of you who have participated in his sessions, I'm sure each of you could attest to the compelling and inspirational teaching style and how he challenges the way we typically engage with our unhappy, angry, or even outraged stakeholders, or as he terms them, fanatics. Thank you, Peter, for agreeing to join the panel discussion. And of course, our chair for this evening, we couldn't go past inviting Jill Hannaford from GHD. In her early professional years, she says in last century, when Jill was a graduate working on transport and water engineering projects, she realised the engineers she was working with could come up with fantastic technical solutions and the environmental professionals could do excellent impact assessments. But if communities didn't understand a proposal or the technology, then the best solution in the world wasn't going to help. She believed that projects needed to be better understood and saw that in many instances proposals could be improved to better reflect community structure and values. The key was to get community input. She was one of the founders of IOP to Australasia and has been actively involved in encouraging best practice community and stakeholder engagement for over 20 years. She has been at the forefront ever since, a strong mentor to many young people who have chosen a career path in engagement and has been instrumental in working with engineers and scientists to ensure broader understanding of community issues. Late last year, Jill was awarded the inaugural Consult Australia Female Champion of Change, a national award for her contribution to community engagement profession in Australia, her involvement with career trackers and her significant contribution to diversity at GHD. Her long-held passion has focused on better community understanding of infrastructure and diversity of thinking about the ways we develop our cities and regional areas. It is with great pleasure that we invite Jill to chair the panel discussion this evening. And on that note, I'll hand over to Jill.
Thank you very much, Bob. I feel like we need a log fire and then we could all really sit back and relax. Some of you have got drinks, which looks good. So we're going to keep this session relatively informal and not go too much over time. So I'm going to ask Rob and Peter a few questions and then open up to you guys to ask questions of them as well. So I'll start firstly by asking Peter, what do you think the fundamental difference between stakeholder or community engagement, as we refer to it in New South Wales in particular, and your outrage management concept is?
Well, I mean, classically, the assumption of community engagement is you've got rational, calm people who have wisdom to contribute. And the community engagement professional brings them together and helps them share their wisdom with each other, the end result of which being a better project. That's very idealistic, and I by no means mean to imply that all community engagement people subscribe to that very idealistic description, but that's the classic vision of community engagement, is calm, rational people sharing their wisdom. The assumption of what I call outrage management is that the tech specs for community engagement haven't been met. At least some people who may or may not have wisdom to contribute are not calm and are not at the moment feeling like sounding rational. They want to vent. They have grievances that they want to be heard. They may actually want to stop the project rather than contribute to the project. And, you know, in case any of you don't realize that, stopping a project is every bit as legitimate a goal as contributing to a project. It's just not as useful in your meeting. But it's as much a part of democracy. So the assumptions are very different, and because of those different assumptions, there are very different sort of values and norms. One of the sort of assumptions behind community engagement is if you want apathetic people to come. Even apathetic people have wisdom to contribute, so you want them to come. The assumption of outrage management is if people are apathetic, thank God you don't have to deal with them. Leave them alone, let them stay home, because you're busy dealing with the people who are upset. Another assumption, I think, of stakeholder engagement is that, you know, it's not acceptable to be nasty. You're not supposed to be rude, you're not supposed to use dirty words, you're not supposed to use personal attacks. You're not supposed to try to dominate the evening. You're not supposed to hijack the agenda. And good facilitators try in stakeholder engagement to prevent those activities as not legitimate. In outrage management, those might be very useful things to let happen. If people come to vent, let them vent. If they want to yell at you, let them yell at you. So I think there are very different underlying norms and assumptions. All of that notwithstanding, there are also a lot that they have in common. I mean, they're, you know, both stakeholder engagement and outrage management put a high value on transparency, put a high value on integrity, put a high value on listening, put a high value on summarizing what you have heard. I mean, you know, if you look at the IAP2 as sort of, you know, the defining organization of stakeholder engagement, you look at what IAP2 says, a lot of it is absolutely compatible with outrage management, and a lot of it is completely different.
So, Rob, what's your comment on that based on how you think we do things in New South Wales? And do the two meet?
Well, I think Peter is looking particularly at the people, and his methods talk about looking at the people who are actually, you're asking for their feedback. I think in our systems, often because we've got a focus on being procedurally fair, we're actually driving to treat everybody the same, yet everyone has different interests. And I think often the result of that is even informal engagement processes, even when run informally, rather than resolving the conflict or figuring ways in which to mitigate it, we often just end up stifling it. So that you leave a public meeting thinking, oh, that was great, everyone's happy, when actually they're not. There was just not the capacity for them to engage at a deliberative, genuine level.
Yeah. So on that, what do you think the real purpose of stakeholder and community engagement is, and what can government agencies get out of that? Sometimes it will lead to, or you'll be experiencing outrage, but just generally in terms of the whole philosophy of engagement, what do you think government agencies can get out of it?
Well, the first thing is to actually ask why you are consulting. That's the first thing. There are really two broad categories of stakeholder engagement. One is because you are seeking to get legitimacy for a decision, because you can say, well, we have spoken to everybody. The second is because you're actually interested in what they have to say and you want to make the project better by listening to people who have views that you don't have access to. So typically, in a community sense, one of the hardest things to define is the social impacts of a proposal. The only people who can tell you are the people in that community. You can't get expert advice as easily on social impacts as you can, for example, on economic analysis or on environment or on rational science. So to do that, you have to talk to the affected communities and people who might have lived in an area for a long time have a perspective that they can share things that you might otherwise not know. So they're the two reasons. But if you're consulting because you want to make your decision legitimate, well, it can only be legitimate because you've listened to what people have to say. Otherwise, you're just adding a veneer of venality that actually makes the sense of disillusionment and loss worse when you're consulting to get a veneer of legitimacy for a decision that's already been made. I think in those cases, you're better off telling people, actually, we're not interested in what you have to say. This is the decision. And then you're communicating why it's the decision. But generally, we've had lots of experience of that, and that doesn't work, which is why we consult.
Peter, what do you say? What are your comments on Rob's summary there?
I buy all of it. I mean, the only thing that I would add is sometimes the whole is greater than the sum of the parts. That, you know, you come into a consulting relationship with the community, you come in with your own ideas, you come in with plans. Hopefully you don't come in with very detailed plans, because the earlier you consult and the more open questions there are, the more meaningful the consultation is likely to be. But you come in with your own ideas. When you hear their ideas, sometimes, you know, as Rob says, their ideas add to yours. Sometimes their ideas flat out conflict with yours, and then there is opportunity perhaps for compromise. And sometimes their ideas trigger some kind of synergy, And collectively, you come up with something that's better than their ideas and better than your ideas. And I've certainly watched that happen with clients, including clients over the last couple of weeks here in Australia, that community engagement can produce a synthesis that is better than what the planning agency intended and better than what the stakeholders demanded. You don't get that every time, but that's the gold standard.
Yeah, and I might put that to the audience a bit later. How often do you think that actually happens in what we do? But my next question really is around how can you tell when community members or stakeholders are legitimately wanting to engage and be involved and contribute versus just trying to really disrupt the project and, throw the government a curveball? Rob, do you want to answer that one?
Yeah, well, I mean, I think the first thing is, particularly at the moment in New South Wales, as an example, the Premier is saying to people over the next decade, you should expect disruption. There's a whole lot of things that we're doing that are going to be disruptive. So in many ways, if there's a broader case as to why some of these infrastructure changes and so forth are necessary, there's a level of broad acceptance and understanding of the directions, but you have to anticipate when you go in to consult on particular projects, the people who are going to participate are generally those who are disaffected. So you're going to start with a position of people are often going to want to derail the outcome. And that's absolutely fine, that's their right to do. I do not think you then seek to label them as people who are somehow have illegitimate views. That's not the case at all, but you have to manage that as best you can and mitigate the impacts of change as much as you can whilst recognising what is in the interest of the broader public. The challenge with that, of course, is selecting publics and who is the public that you're trying to consult with, and that will change from circumstance to circumstance. But again, my thinking of this comes from Garrett Hardin's essay from 1968, The Tragedy of the Commons, where he made the point that it's the assets held in common by the community that are those are valued by nobody because no one has a personal stake in them in their proper management. I think this is we have the same issues when the people who are attracted to be engaged are those whose personal interests are at stake. Those who are broadly happy one way or the other or aren't affected aren't going to give their view. And that's one of the challenges you have to manage.
Yeah. So Peter, do you want to just talk a bit about the fanatics?
Yeah, I fervently agree with Rob that people who want to disrupt the project or stop the project or hijack the meeting are exercising good democratic skills, what they're doing is every bit as legitimate as what anybody else in the room is doing. And you said that, and not everyone in your role would say that. So I very much admire that, and I certainly agree with it. The thing that I would add is when people are trying to hijack the meeting, when people that I tend to call fanatics have very extreme views, they normally have followers who are significantly less extreme. And the label I often give for them is attentives. And when you are dialoguing with fanatics, and I don't think of that as an insulting word, but when you're dialoguing with fanatics, it is in some ways theater. And what you're really doing is not trying to satisfy the fanatics, which may well be not a doable thing. I mean, they may be determined to stop you no matter what concessions you make. But their followers, their attentives, are very interested in the concessions you make. So, I mean, what I routinely say to clients is, as you make concessions to fanatics, what you're doing is persuading attentives, but not fanatics, that the fanatics have won enough. So the fanatics demand A and B and C, and you give them A and B and C, and they're not satisfied, so they demand D and E and F, and you give them D and a little of E, but you can't really give them F, and then they demand G and H and I, and their demands are getting more and more extreme, and more peripheral, and more distant from their original demands, and the attentives are getting bored. The attentives are beginning to think, can't these people be satisfied? Look how much you've given them already. And as the attentives lose interest in the battle and begin to think that, and it's not that the attentives think you're right and the fanatics are wrong, they think the fanatics are right and you have learned from the fanatics and you have taken the fanatics' position on board, and now it's time for you to be allowed to build the project. Thanks to the fanatics for making you change it, but now that you changed it, let's get on with it. The fanatics don't want that. They want, they want to fight forever. But the attentives eventually decide that the fanatics have won enough. That's good enough. You know, if the fanatics have lost their constituency, maybe they declare victory because, you know, when they've lost their constituency, it would be wise to declare victory. And if they don't declare victory, then, you know, then they keep fighting, but they don't have a constituency anymore. Basically, if you can get the fanatics to declare victory, it's over. If you can't get the fanatics to declare victory, if you can get the attentives to be bored and to think the fanatics have won enough, it's also over. Okay. Does that help?
Yeah, so I'm going to ask you one more question before I open it up to the floor. But you've both touched on an element that lots of people in the room will be very aware of and wondering what to do about, and that is that whole concept of fatigue. So community members, stakeholders, government agencies, I'm sure, people in politics are really wondering about how much more they can engage communities, how much more they can ask them to participate, how long the engagement's going to go on for. So can you both just give me a little bit of thought on engagement fatigue, how long the outrage can go for, what to do about it if it goes on forever in the context of, you know, getting on with things.
Boy, that's a tough one. I mean, it's absolutely true. People demand a role, people demand to be heard, but it's not their day job. You know, it's a lot of people in this room, it's your day job to listen to them. But it's not their day job to be listened to. They have a life, they have a family, they have a job, they have all kinds of other commitments, and this is a burden on them. And you know, they are demanding that burden, but they're not happy to have to do it. I haven't got a solution. I mean, the more willing you are to listen, the more projects you have, the more open you are to stakeholder engagement, the higher the burden on your stakeholders. You know, now I understand it's a burden on the public engagement people too, but they're getting paid for that burden. You know, the stakeholders are not getting paid for that burden, and it's a genuine problem. Maybe it's a good thing that it's a genuine problem. I mean, it's an incentive to go home and get on with life and let the make force changes, settle for half a loaf, and move on. So maybe it's not so much a problem as a good thing. But it is a burden, and I certainly have encountered situations where stakeholders are simultaneously saying three things that are incompatible with each other. One, they're saying, I demand a hearing. Two, they're saying, I'm sick and tired of coming to meetings. And three, they're saying, no, it would be unethical for you to pay me for my attendance. So it leaves you with no good answer.
I think part of the answer is actually in that, coming back to that idea of why are we asking people to participate. If we are interested in what we have, on what they have to say, then it should be up to us to encourage them to keep participating. And maybe that's where we can be a little bit more artists than scientists in identifying who really we need to talk to in a particular context. There's going to be those who want to have a say no matter what, so we don't need to worry about them so much. But it might be those who we are actually really interested in what they might have to say about a particular project, because they might represent a section of the community that might otherwise not speak. And we need to encourage them to stay engaged, and we need to have processes that encourage that. I think this sense, and something that I'm keen to look at, and any system will create avenues like this, where projects might be able to be, there might be an agreement about a project outcome, but then a modification might come in, which might be very significant, which might undermine all the good work that was done in the consultation in the first place, which is obviously very disillusioning for people and leads to people to throw up their hands and walk away from the process. So we do need to address that to make sure that the results of a process are actually respected and honoured, That's something, and that's a matter for government to do. But make no mistake, no matter which process we devise, there will always be someone who finds a way around it. So we've just got to keep, that's why certainly in planning processes, you're never going to come up with a perfect set of laws or guidelines or policies, because there's always someone trying to figure their way around them. So you're going to have to keep working at it.
Yeah. Okay. Let's open up to the floor. Who's got a question for Peter or Rob?
Someone's got something.
Mm-hmm. Thanks, Vivian.
Hi. Somebody needs to start, so I'll throw one. What I've heard tonight has been a lot. The word that's come out all the time is about projects. And projects are inevitably things that have been started as a result of a problem. So you have a problem and you create a project to try and respond to that problem. My question is, how can we better engage people with the problem at the beginning rather than waiting until we have a project that we then have to say we have this project and people can start not liking it? If we start with a problem and we try and share exactly what the problem is, and often we assume we know it, but when we start talking to people, the problem looks different to them, perhaps we get a better opportunity to be a bit more thoughtful.
Yep. Peter,
probably a statement, but how do you feel about that?
I might go to Peter to respond to that one.
This is only a partial response, but the earlier in the project you do your consultation, the more it's about the problem. Early on in a project, all you're really doing is problem identification and trying to figure out, well, what are some of the ways we might address this problem, and would this help, and would that help, and would this other help? And, one of the things that I think all good stakeholder engagement people do is encourage their clients to engage earlier. And it's very hard for clients to want to do that, because clients don't like looking stupid and they don't like looking unprepared, and professional planners feel like they ought to dot the I's and cross the T's and have blueprints before they talk to anybody. They really want detailed documents before they talk to anybody, and that's exactly the opposite of what you're asking for. What they really need to do is come in and say, we're trying to figure out what in the hell to do with this neighborhood. And it's got this amenity, and it's got this slum, and it's got this problem, and it's got this situation, and we're trying to figure out, how to deal with it. Now, they don't have to come in completely ignorant. They can come in and say, we've thought of a few things. We think we might do this. We think we might do this. We think we might do this. What do you think of those three ideas? And can you think of any better ideas? But that's sort of a little bit in the middle between coming in with a problem and coming in with a project. It's coming in very, very early in the process of turning a problem into a project. And I have sometimes said that you can measure the genuineness of a consultation by two variables. The first variable is how early is it? And the second variable, which is very much correlated with the first, is how many questions are you asking, as opposed to statements to which you are seeking response. So if you're coming in saying, here's what we want to do, what do you think? That almost defines it by definition as very late and not very useful consultation. If you're coming in thinking, with saying, what do you think we should do about this? What do you think we should do about that? What about this other? The more question marks in the document you present to people, the closer you are to your paradigm of coming forward with a problem, not a project.
And Rob, do the community say, come on, just get on with it? What's your experience in that?
No, well, it depends again which public. And in one sense, what Vivian's talking about also relates to the NIMBYs. They understand the need for a particular change, they just don't want it next to them. So that's fine. And there's an important role for NIMBYs. The whole Greens ban was kicked off effectively by a bunch in Woolwich Peninsula who were fighting against a particular housing development. And there was probably good reason as to why they were fighting that at the time. So I'm not saying NIMBYs is an illegitimate position. It's just then up to them to explain, well, why not in my backyard? What about my backyard has influence on the rest of the public that it means that your views have a wider application. But also, not every project is solving a problem. It may be for government, but for private developers, that they may not. There they might just be seeking to justify. It can often be more difficult for them because they can't actually point to a problem that they're seeking to solve.
Yeah, no, they're creating one.
Yeah.
Yeah. So, question over there, and then the front.
Yeah. Hi, Michael Alf from your favourite consultancy. 2011 was the year that Time magazine gave Person of the Year to The Protester. And there's a lovely photo essay in if you have a look through it. And most of the people protesting have got their smartphone with them, whether they be part of the Arab Spring or whatever else. My question is around social media and online engagement. And I suppose to Minister, how do you see that affecting the planning process? And to Peter, do you think that's changing the outrage management process at all?
Well, the first thing I'd say is there's a tremendous opportunity with it. It's very challenging, I suppose, to manage in our existing legal processes that are very much notice and comment, and so it's a more iterative process, and it's also more anonymous. So it's people can verbalise their views much more directly than they might through a formal process, and we can reach people who might otherwise not get involved. And the My Sydney campaign that DPE ran was a good example of how to try and develop a photo essay of people who this is what I like about Sydney, or this is what I don't like, or whatever the case might be. So we can use it really, really well as an engagement tool. But I think the challenges with it will always be, well, how do we equate it with different forms of people getting involved in processes? I think it's always been fascinating. I used to be a planning lawyer before I got into politics, and I was always fascinated when local groups that I advise would try to come with, in relation to a particular DA, would try and answer questions about environmental impacts or economic impacts, when really that wasn't what they were competent to be able to talk about. The one thing they could talk about was what it mattered, how it affected them and their experience of place or of society in that particular location. But somehow they didn't see that as a valid way in which to respond. They thought, oh, people won't be interested to hear that. And I was, no, that's the one thing that you can talk about that no one else can talk about because you live there. And so in the same way, we need to find how we can embrace the way that people might choose to communicate through a whole variety of different mediums to make that useful. That's the challenge.
And Peter, what about your outrage area and social media?
I mean, social media are absolutely the ideal vehicle for the expression and exacerbation of outrage. I mean, if you're going to design a tool for spreading outrage and magnifying outrage, you would design social media. But, you know, responding to outrage has to happen in the venues where the expression of outrage happens. There's just no point in responding in a different venue. So, tough. You know, it's not the ideal venue. It's more in their interests than it is in yours. But it is the venue in which the response has to happen. So I think outrage management via social media is absolutely essential. It's where most outrage management now has to happen because it's where the outrage is being expressed. The main burden that creates is social media work very, very quickly. There's no longer a news cycle. The leisurely pace of getting, once upon a time when I was a young consultant, you got a letter of complaint, and you passed it around from person to person and you looked at it and you said, I don't know what to do about that. Let me put it aside and we'll think about it in a few days. And, you know, 2 or 3 or 4 weeks later, somebody, if you were a pretty decent organization, would write an answer. And it was just, it's just the letter writer and the answerer with a month in between. Okay, now that letter writer doesn't write a letter. Nobody's written a letter in years. That letter writer, tweets. you know, or they post on Facebook, and they have dozens of responses in minutes and hundreds of responses, maybe thousands of responses in hours. They're getting retweeted, they're going viral, and you're still, you know, you haven't noticed it yet, you haven't seen it yet. Or if you've seen it, you've passed it up the hierarchy, and 3 or 4 days from now, someone in your organization will begin to craft a response, which is, of course, 3 or 4 days too late. You know, so given that you have to respond quickly, the only way I know to have sufficiently fast social media response to outrage is to decentralize the response. And this is terrifying to my clients. You basically have to say to all your people, if you see somebody saying something about our organization and you want to answer, God bless, answer. You know, because by the time we see it, it'll be much too late. You go ahead and you know, you saw it. It's the media that you're, social media that you're used to being on. You, they may know you. You may know them, you know, by, you know, by your gnome de Facebook or whatever. Go ahead and do it. You give your people a little bit of training, you give your people a lot of trust and a lot of freedom, and sometimes they will mess up badly. Sometimes they will respond to a criticism very defensively and make things much worse. But at least they responded, and with a little help and a little freedom, very often you get your people responding in decent ways long before the organization could. Now, I have to say one more thing. You know, my typical client takes maybe 30% of my advice. Nobody ever takes all of my advice. It would terrify me if they did. I mean, you know, I mean, it's my safety is, well, if they'd done it all, it would have worked. You know, so I'm very accustomed to them not doing it all. But some of the things I advise clients, you know, really usually take to heart. And some of the things I advise, they never take to heart. The one I just said, they never take to heart. Okay? I have yet to have a client say, okay, we're going to authorize all our people to respond to social media criticism without having to check with anybody, without having to pass it up the organization's hierarchy. You know, I have yet to have a client do it. I am absolutely convinced that 20 years from now, that's what everybody will be doing. It's the only way it can be done. But at the moment, no organization or very few organizations are doing it that way. So what they're doing instead is not responding, or responding so belatedly they might just as well have not responded.
Okay. Thank you. Lucy.
Lucy Cole-Edelson from Straight Talk. My question is to the Minister. Minister, we've got a really interesting situation, particularly across the metropolitan area, where we have a multitude of significant changes and projects. Some of those projects, the engagement's occurring really early. Some of those projects, it's not. And I think that I'm interested to understand what, because it seems to me that the change that's actually needed in this instance is not even, well, clearly across the bureaucracy, but also within the elected officials, because there's not a lot of coordination. So, for example, we have urban growth who are going out doing early engagement on a range of really exciting great urban renewal projects, but the people who live in those areas haven't been asked if they want those many thousands of people to come, and that's what is upsetting them along with the Heights. And you know, you have similar outrage like that with some of the motorway projects like WestConnex and NorthConnex. But the other thing that we've got is these projects are now bumping up against each other. So, you know, the light rail removal of trees, which had been assessed by EIS and which there had been engagement on, but as with all of these things, it's a slow snowball. But the impact of that is now not just for the light rail project and Sydney Morning Herald coverage, but for other agencies. So other agencies working in that vicinity are now copping a hiding because of that. So there seems to be a couple of things that government could do if we had a champion in government, and one of those would be to lead some conversations around coordination and just some understanding of what that bigger picture is. But I think the other conversation that we need, and we actually need leadership from all ministers and members of the government on, is that bigger conversation about the change that Sydney is confronting. We are the economic heartland of the country. We don't have the infrastructure to support the people who need to come here and who need to look after me when I'm old. And that those changes are going to mean impacts, but they're also going to mean fantastic benefits. And while parts of our, and if you look at some of those urban renewal areas, and the Central to Everleigh one is a classic example, there will be significant changes in some established parts of Sydney. But there will be no change, and the character and amenity of the remainder of that suburb will be will be maintained. That's a story we're not having, and we actually need some leadership. So I'm interested in your response to that.
Yeah, I mean, I think the first thing is, the Premier's very keen to get the message out about disruption, that the fact is there will be a lot of change, and that's the nature of living in Sydney, and that's what people like and loathe about it. So, in other words, you know, make no apologies for it, it's happening. I suppose part of it, and I think the Sydney Light Rail was an example where it was done reasonably well in terms of the changes to the bus timetable, for example, where in that case we planned for Armageddon, and then when it didn't happen, it was okay. If it had happened, we would have been ready for it. It's a bit late to respond to Armageddon. You've got to expect it. So on all these projects, and I think the urban growth is right in the eye of the storm on this, and that's why early consultation is important, because a lot of the messages, particularly urban growth is bringing, are ones that are messages of surprise. In the planning system generally, what I want to try and achieve is a system where people won't be surprised by development. If they expect it, they may not like it, but they understand they can make decisions about what's likely to happen over time. That's why it's really important. We encourage councils to regularly update their planning controls so that if it's done every 5 years, people have a sense of gradual change rather than having to do it once every 20 years and upsetting everybody. I think often in those circumstances, you can quite easily redeem the situation by actually looking at it objectively. And of course, that would be a logical spot in which to look for an urban renewal outcome. I think we need to be very careful, though, with euphemisms for change. Urban renewal is almost the latest one. We used urban consolidation, compact cities, urban compaction. There's all sorts of sort of almost Orwellian phrases we use to not describe what we're talking about. So we've got to be careful with that. And language is really, really important here. Words matter in this space. That's something I have learned. You've got to be really careful with the words we use and actually pick up on what speaks to people about that change. In terms of coordinating different agencies, doing different things at different times, I suppose that's a world all of us inhabit, but me as well. We've got to do the best we can. Certainly the Greater Sydney Commission is an effort to do... there's a guy called Kelvin Campbell at University College London who talks about the smart urbanism, this massive small movement, which is all about, yes, you need top-down central control and direction, but you also need to respect the need for bottom-up approaches as well. So what the Greater Sydney Commission is trying to do is, yes, there's some top-down stuff in terms of the central agencies, there's some bottom-up in terms of the district commissioners who represent the councils, so you've got that vertical axis, and along the horizontal axis you've got all the different agencies who are working, who have a context in which they can work together. So you're trying to bring government together here and this way as well. That's the concept behind it. The other thing, we have to learn how to do it better iteratively over time. There is no single way that we can consolidate and coordinate everything perfectly. There have been countless coordinator generals in various states and things that have never just added another layer. And I think one of the things I've learnt, and I learnt this through integrated development, which was brought in the late 90s as the cure-all at the time. That was the neoliberal response. We were, rather than the applicant having to go here to get this permit and here to get this permit and here to get that licence and here to get that application, instead you were going to go to the council and the council was going to do it all for you. But of course the problem was the council officer, they've got their 9-day fortnight, they've got to leave on the 5 o'clock to pick up kids. No problem with the council planner, but they really couldn't care about your DA, really. That's not their job. Their job is to administer the process. They don't work for the applicant, and nor should they. But the applicant is the one with the interest in getting all the applications and all the permits. So in one sense, we were too clever by half because we forgot who actually has the interests. One of the things we need to break down in this spot is examining what the interests of different people are in a process. And the law doesn't do that for us very well, and government doesn't do that for us very well. Government struggles in looking at different people's interests because in one sense it's almost a bit inappropriate to understand what people's interests are. In one sense we shouldn't care, we should treat everybody the same. And the law certainly doesn't recognise people have different interests. A good example is an American planning lawyer, Eric Freyfogle, who talks a lot about this, when he said that when we developed our property laws, everyone who owned land back in the 1700s, the only reason you owned land was for productive purposes. So whether you were a landlord who had some serfs and some farms, or whether you had a new factory, you owned land for productive purposes. It was before mass suburbanisation. And so everyone in property law, according to Freyfogle's analysis, has the same rights, but they have entirely different interests. So you might have developer X whose interest in making a quick buck and moving on to the next site. Nothing wrong with that, but that's his or her interest. But then you've got the family who live next door who actually their interest is in everything staying pretty much the same for the next 20 years. They've got exactly the same rights, but their interests are entirely different, which sets up a conflict straight away. So I think actually understanding where everyone is coming from is probably one of the most important things we can do, because if we don't understand that, then we're never going to resolve anything.
Yeah. Okay, I'm just conscious of the time, so I think we've got a question up the back, Peter.
Yeah,
and then we'll get a last comment from the panel.
Yeah, hi, Peter Lintout's my name, and I thought we'd give Rob a break and go out of Sydney and out of Australia and ask Peter to share a community health case study, as I believe you've been involved in managing the Zika virus. So I thought that'd be a great case study around what some of your insights have been around how to engage with that crisis in that community.
Oh Lord, I could talk about Zika for the rest of the night, but nobody wants to hear it. Okay, I mean, it's not predominantly outrage management. The underlying principle of my approach, which a lot of you have heard over the last few days, the underlying principle of my approach is you know, you've got two variables, how dangerous a risk is and how upsetting that risk is. And what you do depends entirely on what combination of how dangerous it is and how upsetting it is you're up against. You know, so if it's very dangerous but not very upsetting, that's one set of problems. If it's very upsetting and not very dangerous, that's a second set of problems. If it's very dangerous and very upsetting, that's a third set of problems. The thing about Zika virus is it represents different problems for different publics. If you live in or have traveled to a place where the Aedes aegypti mosquito hangs out, and a place where that's the mosquito that transmits Zika, and a place where Zika is already transmitting, particularly if you're a pregnant woman, or if you're hoping to become a pregnant woman, if you're looking to have a baby, you know, then it's high hazard, high outrage. You know, you are genuinely endangered and you are genuinely upset. Those are the tech specs for crisis communication. So, you know, I have been helping the US CDC talk to women who live in Puerto Rico, where the Zika virus is spreading, or talk to women in the continental United States who have traveled to Puerto Rico or traveled to Brazil or traveled to places. And you know, if you're pregnant and particularly if you had Zika symptoms and now you think you probably had Zika and you're pregnant and you're thinking, oh my God, what is my baby going to be like? You know, depending on your values about abortion, you may be thinking, should I get an abortion? If that's not a living option for you, then you're thinking, how am I going to cope? How is my spouse going to cope if you have a spouse? What about my other children? Horrible, horrible fears. Okay, are you with me? That's crisis communication. Okay. Meanwhile, there are lots of other people who are not at all worried. And they should be, people, particularly again in Puerto Rico, to whom you have to say, this really is about you. You're not reading those stories. You're kind of more interested in rock music than you are in virology. But this is serious, and we're trying to get you to get rid of standing water. The Aedes aegypti mosquito can propagate in a bottle cap of water. They require very little water. So this is not just, going after huge pieces of standing water. This is really policing your neighborhood for even tiny places where the mosquito can propagate. You asked for this, I'm sorry. And the mosquito doesn't travel much, so local is what it's all about. And it's less about insecticides than it is about vector control. So you're trying to persuade people to do that. You're trying to persuade people to use insecticide and to use the right insecticide and to use it as recommended. All of that is what I call precaution advocacy. They are not upset, and they should be, because they are genuinely endangered. Meanwhile, back in the continental United States, you have a whole lot of people who live in places where the Aedes aegypti mosquito never goes. And they are never going to get Zika locally. There will be no local Zika transmission in those parts of the United States. The only risk now is to travelers who will come back with it and not give it to anybody, because you can't, that's not true. It can transmit by sex, but that's the exception rather than the rule. By and large, you get it from a mosquito who got it from someone who was already infected. If someone comes back already infected and the right mosquito isn't around, it's a dead end for the virus. Okay? So now you got some people who are rightly upset and should be, and you have to help guide them through it. You've got some people who should be upset, but they're not, and you have to shake them by their collective lapels and say, for God's sake, take this seriously. And you have a huge number of people who shouldn't be upset, but they are, and you have to calm them down. So all three of the paradigms of risk communication are in play at the same time.
101 Zika. Thank you very much, Peter. So look, we're going to close the panel session this evening, and I would like to say a very big thank you to Peter and Rob for sharing their insights with us. I'm just going to ask you to both have one final comment and tell me what, Peter, particularly you, what have you observed after being with all the people in Australia for the last few days and talking to them in depth about outrage management? And Rob, what's the one thing you will take away from what you've seen over the last few days about outrage management? So Peter, do you want to start?
That's great. First I'll talk about me and then you talk about me. I love it. I love it. I love coming to Australia. This is my 30-something trip to Australia. Apart from all the reasons that everybody loves Australia and everybody loves Sydney, I have found that my approach goes over better in Australia than anywhere else in the world, including the United States. Yours is a culture that values transparency. It's a culture that values mutual respect. It's a culture that really can hear the kinds of things that I'm saying about outrage management. It's hard even for you, okay? But it's easier for you than it is for Americans. It's easier for Americans than it is for Europeans. It's easier for Europeans than it is for Japanese. And I can go further. I have clients all over the world, and Australia is right up at the top of my list as the lowest hanging fruit, the easiest people to talk into this stuff. So it's always a pleasure to come here professionally. The other thing that I will say is I will very often work with a client and I'll come back a year later and it's like I wasn't there the first time. It's wonderful business plan. They can bring me back every year and never learn anything, but it's not soul satisfying. And this trip, I have been, you know, particularly the groups I worked with, and Urban Growth, I'm thinking in particular, is a group I have worked with now for several years. And I just can't tell you how joyful it is to come back and see progress, and come back and see that you don't want the intro course anymore. You know that stuff already, and you're presenting to me more advanced problems. You've moved down the road, and that's very soul satisfying. Some of the groups I worked with in the last week, it was my first time with you, and you will have an opportunity to satisfy my soul by making progress in the next year, and then bring me back and let me see that you have moved down the road. So it's just wonderful to work with people who give me a fair hearing, take it on board, and actually make some progress on it.
Good, thank you. Rob?
Okay, well, I've learned a couple of things. I mean, certainly I had the opportunity before opening the session last week to read a few of your works. And I suppose one of the things that it's made me reflect upon is a little bit like some of the, you know, IBM used to in the 80s or McKinsey does today. They take top people from various fields and then forget what they know and retrain them in a way of thinking. Not suggesting that should happen within government, but we've got lots of great scientists, lots of great planners, lots of great specialists in a whole variety of fields, but all of that in one sense counts for naught unless we can communicate effectively with the people whom our decisions are going to impact. And that's really the missing piece that you've been talking about. And it's made me reflect as well that in all our decision making, we've gotten very good at looking at risk in a tangible way, but not so much the reputational way. We can identify environmental risks, we can identify economic risks, but what we're not as good at is identifying how is the risk of people not accepting the decision, those social risks with decision making, which is becoming more and more relevant. And I think our processes have accepted scientific rationality, have accepted economic rationality, but this idea of the other sorts of reason that make people think, we haven't focused on them as much, and they're equally important if our objective is to make people's lives better by building an inclusive society where people have access to opportunities. If that's what we're trying to do, it's not good enough that we know that the decisions we're making are right. We actually have to be able to explain them clearly to people. And even if people, from their own personal perspective, may not be all that thrilled with the decision, at least they can feel heard and they have access to understanding, if they want to, why that decision was made. And that's really what I think is what I've taken from what your message is, and one that I think is critical if we're going to do what it is the public need us to do.
Great, thank you very much. I'd like you all to join me in thanking three people. I really like to thank you to Peter and Rob for sharing their insights with us this evening. But I also wanted to thank Barbara Campany, who has, it is part of her job, but she has done the organising and facilitating and coordinating of the last few days of having Dr. Sandman here with great joy along the way, and has always been able to make sure that we all know where we need to be and to make the whole event happen. So thank you very much, Barb, but please join me in thanking Peter and Rob.